People who weren't here, they missed it. It's on them.
Don't share your notes with them. They deserve not to know what I say.
All right.
Outraged, outraged, outraged. Why? Simple. Under British common law, property is sacrosanct. The British, and by the way, we have the same view in our country. We inherited it from England. The belief that if you own something, it's yours. And if someone takes it or damages it or destroys it, you are entitled to compensation. Plus, the Brits were like, we're engaged in the free trade zone, the Asian trade network. Remember what I said previously? There never was anyone who controlled it. There never was any regulations. You could basically bring in anything you wanted, and if someone wanted to get it, they would barter and exchange it. So the Brits are like, yo, Lin Chiu, you're violating your own terms. We will not stand it. Stand for it. So, if you don't stop, you're risking military intervention. Well, Lin Chiu did not care. He was tasked by his government to do a job. He was not answerable to the British. He was answerable to the emperor. And he was going to protect his people. Questions?
When was the Hague created? When was the Hague created?
I think the 1880s, 1890s.
Later.
Yeah, after this. Well, the Brits warned. Lin continued to destroy opium. And in the end, a war would erupt. Arguably one of the most significant wars of the 19th century. The Opium War. The war would erupt in 1839 and it would last until 1842. As far as wars go, it really wasn't like a modern war in any shape, sense, or form. In truth, the actual battles were really quick. But as I've said before, maybe back in the day when you had old wars, there was a state of war. So war was declared, and technically you were still warring until a peace was negotiated, settled. And it began with an ultimatum. Lin Chiu must pay the Brits compensatory damages. Again, if I take your computer and I smash it on the ground, you're going to take me to the court, and the court's going to force me to pay you for a new computer. That's what the Brits demand did. Well, the Qing refused. Why?
The Chinese threw back to the Brits legality, legalism.
At one of the other colleges I used to work at, I used to teach a business law class.
And I gave them an essay on an exam.
And very few students could ever get it right.
Because most students have a complete misconception of how our legal system works.
So I'm going to play a game, and I'm going to see how smart you all are.
You come home one day, and sitting on your porch step is a big bag of any illegal substance that you can think of. I'll make it simple. I'll say cocaine. It's in a nice big brown paper bag, sitting, boom, right on your door. Almost like Amazon dropped it off. You pick up the drugs. You take them into your house. You call the cops. Hello, Mr. Police Officer. I just got this big bag of cocaine. It's not mine. I would like to give it to you. Policeman comes, takes the drugs, destroys the drugs. Life is good. They pat you on the back. But then your neighbor comes over, knocks on your door. Hey, did you get a package? You say, yes, I did. It was full of drugs. I gave it to the police. They took it away and they destroyed it. He patted me on the back. I feel good. Then your neighbor goes to you, know something? I'm going to sue you. And he goes down to court and files a claim against you, seeking damages in the amount of the street value of that cocaine. Does he win? You hope not, but probably. How is he going to win? All right, I'll ask it a different way. Do you have a legal right to commit a crime?
No.
In any circumstance?
A legal right to commit. That's not the case anymore.
Do you have a legal right to commit a crime?
Yeah, like if someone like break and enters, you can like shoot them, right? Just to, like,
do you have a right to shoot them? Do you still have a right to shoot him, even if they have a gun at you?
And
then
pointing at you, you have a right to protect
yourself. Right to defend yourself, right?
At that level.
Wow, amazingly, legally speaking, you're all wrong. You do not have a right to commit a crime, ever. Now, in the event of someone pulls a gun on you, you pull a gun on them, and you shoot them, well, it really depends. You could actually be convicted of murder. Because under Massachusetts, the way law reads, you are legally obligated to retreat to the wall. So if someone pulls out a gun on you, no, you can't go Wild West on them. You have a legal duty to run away until you can run no more. Only when you are trapped.
Only when you're shot already?
Yeah, pretty much. Only when you're trapped can you legally fire back.
Right.
And by the way, the reason why you legally can fire back, not that the law allows it, but it's a defense. So you are defending yourself from assault and battery. But you cannot just do it Wild Western style, vigilante style.
No.
As for drug possession, you have no legal right to possess drugs if they're illegal. So yeah, your nitwit neighbor can try suing you, but you know what the court's going to do? Oh, you're dealing drugs? Probable cause is going to report it to the police, and the police is going to show up with a warrant. Well, what does Lin Cixiu tell the British? That's great. In the English Empire, this may be legal, but it's illegal in China. So because it's illegal, you don't have a right to compensation, because you don't have a right to engage in criminal activity. By the way, that's the way it would work in England as well. Lin Cixiu was brilliant. Threw it right back in the Brits' face. But you think the Brits cared? Nope. So, what do? Well, the first thing the Brits do is they move their navy in. Their navy sails into Canton and engages in open fire against all of the more primitive Chinese vessels, commonly referred to as junks. The Brits had a fleet of 45 ships, most of them mast and sail. They were ships of the line, so they had multiple decks of cannon on it, but they actually at this point had 4 steam-powered gunboats. Once they seized control of the sea, they blocked off Canton, they blocked off the access to Shanghai, the 2 major ports that the Chinese allowed trade, they then would launch a 2-stage operation. Simultaneously, they would sail up the Pearl River and get to Canton. They would also sail into the Yangtze River and sail towards Shanghai, and eventually Nanking. Then, once they entered, they obliterated any type of Chinese defenses.
then, once they forced their way in, they landed Marines. Typically referred to as the British Expeditionary Forces. And the Chinese forces, they didn't stand a chance. The Brits would deploy in both locations about 10,000 men, both in Canton and Nanking. The Chinese were able to mobilize 200,000 men, but the Chinese soldiers went into battle with swords and spears. 1840 weaponry, they're still using muskets, but they are now flintlock muskets. So it's not the old matchlock where you had to light it and put some gunpowder into the pan and then you pulled the trigger, you hope that the wick was like hot enough for it to fire. It was more like a Zippo, so you'd get consistent spark. Very, very reliable weapons. Much better than swords and spears. The British also had more lethal artillery. They had iron guns. And while they still were shooting cannonballs, by this point the technology advanced so much that sometimes the cannonballs had fuses in them. They would fire into a shot area and they would explode. So even though they were outnumbered, well, 10 to 1, the British forces pulverized the Chinese. Oh, there we go. British weapons superior. Now, obviously the British didn't have a chance of occupying a country as large as China. But they were not trying to conquer it. They were simply trying to send a message that if we want to come in, we're going to come in, and there's nothing you can do about it. The Qing did try resisting until, out of sheer luck, the British forces occupying Nanking saw vast barges coming down the river. Now, the way the Qing collected their taxes was they sent all of their tax agents out throughout the empire. And if you recall, I did mention in passing that China was connected by canals. You could almost go anywhere by river in all of the empire. So what they would do is they would collect the taxes and they would sail it downstream or upstream and have it arrive in Nanking, which was the summer home of the emperor. Well, unbeknownst to the Chinese agents that are working all throughout China collecting the taxes, the emperor didn't come down to Nanking that year because the British attacked. He was still up in Beijing, the northern capital. So what do the Brits do? Well, they see these barges full of tons of gold and silver and other stuff, and they take them. The entire annual income collection. All the money they collected for an entire year. What can a government do if it has zero tax collections? Nothing. Well, when that occurred, the Qing were like, okay, we'll talk. The emperor at the time was Dao Gunyang. He reached out and sued for peace. Now here's the thing. In the Chinese mind, this would be efforts to negotiate a fair and just solution to what just took place. In the British mind, they just beat the Chinese. The Chinese surrendered. And the victors imposed the terms. And did they? They would impose upon China the Treaty of Nanking. It is, historically speaking, the first of what would become known as unequal treaties. Because again, you think treaty and you think both sides agree. But beginning with this treaty, the British would impose terms that the Chinese had to accept. Advantage England. I'm going to give them to you all the terms, because these terms would be the blueprint of how, incrementally, the Europeans would take control over China. First, 5 ports would be open to British trade, not just 1. Now it's up to 5. And the British were allowed to set up consulates, official government offices, in each of the ports. So, 5 ports and consulates. So, the British could monitor if the Chinese is stopping them from allowing their goods to come in. 2, missionaries had to be allowed into the interior. China had to change its laws, which made it illegal for foreigners to come in. But the British said, just missionaries, that's all. We're going to spread the word of God. Five ports plus consulates, 2 missionaries. 3. I'm going to write this one down. The British would also receive what are known as extraterritorial rights. Extraterritorial rights. Make it real simple. Under the law, if you come into our country, no matter where on earth you are, and you break a law, you are going to be punished under our laws. The same is true as if you go to France, or if you go to Cuba, or if you go to Brazil, or anywhere else on earth. You commit a crime in the country, you're punished under those laws. Well, what England would receive from China is an exception. Under the theory of extraterritorial rights, if a British citizen commits a crime in China, they can be arrested, but they are to be turned over to the British. And they will be charged under British law, not Chinese law. Is it legal to sell opium in China in 1842? Is it legal to sell opium in the British Empire in 1842? So if you get arrested in China selling opium and you're a British citizen, you'll get arrested, but you're going to be turned over to the British. And by the way, what's going to happen to your product, which is also illegal in China? And? No. 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 Eventually. It's going to be given back to the British, because the property is legal in British as well. So, extraterritorial rights. If you're British, you're going to be tried under British law, not Chinese law. Questions on the third part. All right, so notice what we're doing. We have more opportunity to sell. We're going to let our people in. Now, you can't punish us if we do anything illegal. Because, by the way, what do you think all those missionaries are going to be carrying? 4.
Holy water.
Yeah, holy water, all right. 4. They're going to take territory. They're going to take the port of Hong Kong. And it's going to be a sphere of influence. which of course, if you recall, it's one of the three types of colonial activities that the was involved in the Age of New Imperialism.
Was it the Jesuits?
No. England's not Catholic.
Just
yeah, they'd be like Anglican. Yeah. All right. Under international law, a sphere of influence technically is still part of the country that it belongs to, but it's occupied. And it's utilized as if it was part of a foreign empire. Spheres of influence are not put over entire provinces. But usually they're put over important zones, like ports. So effectively, the port of Hong Kong and the land immediately around it would be still technically in China, but it would be governed as if it was part of the British Empire. And England would maintain possession of Hong Kong until, I think it was turned over December 31st, 1999. I remember it on TV.
That's right.
All right. So we got the four big ones so far, and I got one more for you. I said there was five terms in this treaty. So five more ports plus consulates, missionaries, extraterritorial rights, Hong Kong, and lastly, damages. Compensatory damages. China had to pay $21 million ounces of silver for damages for all of the opium that was destroyed. Let me see. Well, that's what I'm going to look. No, that's how much the weight is.
Holy kitty.
So let's see. Silver, not sick veil.
Today?
Silver per ounce.
38 or 39, I think.
Is that high? Well, let's see what Apex says. 33.70. So let's take out the calculator app. I'm glad I don't have to do this in my head because I am awful in math. So let's see. 21 with six zeros times $33.70. So in today's money, $707,700,000. I can tell you one thing, the market value of the tens of thousands of chests that were destroyed was not $700 million. But the Brits didn't care because they won. Now here's the funny thing. The moment all of the other imperial powers saw what England got out of China, they followed in. The first two nations to jump in and get their own treaties equivalent to the Treaty of Nanking, France, and look at this. USA. America. So now what would happen? Well, the Europeans are now starting to penetrate China. Questions?
What was the first two terms of the treaty?
Five ports plus consulates.
Five ports plus consulates.
That's a British official that's going to be in the port.
Okay.
With no problem?
Yeah, he's watching what's going on. Yeah, then missionaries can go.
They're spreading the good word.
Yep. So now, you asked about Jesuits. Well, the moment the French show up, here comes the Jesuits. And Americans, we didn't really have a national religion per se, but they basically sent quote-unquote missionaries that usually were American businessmen. All right. You fight a war, you beat them down, you take a little. Well, here's the problem. Treaties, all treaties, only last for a period of years. They have terms, and the terms expire. So when the terms expire, nations renegotiate. Well, it would be efforts to renegotiate it that would result in a second opium war. And by the way, the causes were the same as the first. The Europeans not getting what they wanted. And what did they want? More. More, more, more. England and their representatives would arrive in China and they began demanding, in addition to those five things, new status. The most important thing they demanded was they wanted to be recognized as a most favorable nation. MFN. Now, this is a standard under modern international law, but it really was just beginning in the 19th century. Under most favorable nation status, the nation that gets it essentially is treated the same as if the business was or entity was a domestic entity. So, to make it simple, you have a British company that sets up business in China. Well, China may give them tax breaks. Well, under MFN, the British company would get the tax breaks as well. Maybe the Chinese would want to impose protective tariffs. Well, the domestic country doesn't pay those domestic tariffs, so the British company in China would not get subject to those tariffs. By the way, this is what Trump is trying to renegotiate now.
Buy our Wedgwood or Peter's parts.
Probably. Yep. So, this essentially would have stripped China's ability to treat foreign companies in a way that was to the advantage of China. FYI, we give that status to many nations, but few nations give it to us today. So that's one of the reasons why, like, the Chinese are coming in and buying farmland. All the farms in the middle of the country that are going out of business, the Chinese are coming in and scooping it up. But they wouldn't let us go into China or buy farmland today. Because, again, Chinese know history. We don't. They also demanded that China should be open to all, not just missionaries. Now they're not even going to try hiding it. They also demanded that China legalize opium. And they demanded police protection. They want the Chinese police to protect British merchants. Well, here's the funny thing. France finds out what England's demanded. And they come in and say, yeah, me too. Well, China was like, why? Why are we going to do this? This is stupid. It makes no sense. But in the middle of the negotiations, if you want to call them, an incident took place involving a ship called the Arrow. The Arrow, as depicted in this painting, was a Chinese junk that had been used by pirates. The Chinese government captured it and then sold it in an auction. A British company bought the ship, paid whatever price the Chinese wanted, sailed it to Hong Kong, and registered it there. But the problem was, is unbeknownst to the ship captain, the registration expired in 1855. So technically, the captain is sailing this ship and it's unregistered. Well, the ship is sailing off the coast of China. It's flying the British flag, but some of the Chinese sailors recognize the ship. Wait, didn't we take that like 4 years ago? So they stop it, they board it, and the Chinese Marines would actually arrest 12 Chinese members of the crew, claiming that they were pirates. They didn't do anything with the British guys. They just took the Chinese. Well, here's the thing. Under Chinese law, if you're born in China, you are a Chinese citizen. Under British law at the time, if you sailed on a British ship, you were treated as a subject of the British crown. So the commander puts his arms up, starts screaming in frustration. Word gets to the consul that's in Canton. Canton contacts the governor general. It's not Lin Qiu at this time. I don't know who his replacement was. But basically makes a demand that we want our crew back. And we want an apology. Well, it was alleged that when the Chinese boarded the ship and the British captain is like, look, we're flying under a British flag, that the commanding officer of the Chinese pulled the flag down, dropped it on the ground, and stepped on it. Saying, no, you're not licensed. You're not a British ship. Well, the Governor General gets this report, gets this claim, and is like, They quickly do a background check and they release 9 of the 12 Chinese guys that were captured. But they don't issue an apology. Simply replying, it was not a British ship. Under the law, if your car is not registered, it's technically not yours. If you don't have a title. So the Brits are outraged. The governor of Hong Kong orders his ships to sail to Canton. They pull into the harbor and they begin opening fire. They begin bombarding the mainland. Then the French sends a flotilla from Vietnam. And the combined fleet of British and French ships began sailing up the coast, opening fire as they move. Soon, the Americans jump in, as do the Russians. Now, truth be told, the American forces were limited. They only sent 2 small gunboats. But the American ships did open fire and attack some of the British Chinese forts. Well, dealing with the combined strength of 4 nations, Chinese were easily defeated. It's estimated that the Allies suffered about 2,800 casualties, where the Chinese suffered about 50,000. And by the way, they didn't keep stats on how many civilians were injured or killed. Seeing how they get their butts whooped, the emperor wants to negotiate peace. The new emperor, Xian Fang, tells the allies, we'll sit down, we'll negotiate. But because he's the son of heaven, he's not going to meet with the barbarians. Instead, he sends his brother, Prince Gong.
It's going to click. I'm pretty sure it's going to go to the next screen. I was right.
Prince Gong meets the ambassadors in the Chinese city of Tientsin. And they hammer out a new treaty. And I have it pluralized because there was one Tientsin treaty for the British, one for the French, one for the Russian, and one for the Americans. And what would they demand? More. Under the Tientsin treaties, they demanded the right to access 10 ports. They also demanded the right to set up permanent embassies. So no more just consulates in the harbor. They wanted to build up embassy buildings inside the capital. FYI though, it was illegal still for foreigners to enter Beijing. That was where the Forbidden City was. So they're demanding the right to build these embassies. Oh, I'm not done yet. Well, I'll give you a picture of Prince Gong. They demanded the right to sail up the Yangtze River, the Yellow River, which is the biggest river in China that goes literally into the heartland. Even with the Three Gorges Dam project, the Yellow River is deep enough that modern ocean-going vessels can sail hundreds of miles into the interior. They also demanded that foreigners of any country could freely travel anywhere in China. So again, it's still the same model as Nanking, but it's more. Embassies, 10 ports, sail up the Yangtze. Anyone can travel anywhere. And of course, because the British and the French suffered the most damage during the battles, they also demanded compensation. Question. Well, Prince Gong is there. He negotiates the treaties. He's kind of appalled at what they're demanding. But he brings the treaty back to his brother, the emperor. And the emperor's like, no way am I going to agree to this. He rejects the terms of the Tientsin treaties. And then he then orders his generals to resist. So, what do the Allies do? Okay, fine. We were primarily attacking the southern part of China where most of the trade comes and goes. But fine, we're going to come north. We're going to come to the capital itself. Now, the Chinese did attempt to protect themselves. After the First Opium War, they would amass a massive string of fortifications along the Hai River. This river, it's not a full map, it's north, but if you sail the river all the way in, you can pretty much get to Beijing. You can sail to the capital. Well, as you can see by these brown, blackish blobs, at strategic points, the Chinese would amass, build fortifications, and they would put artillery there, guns. So when a series of ships would sail in and come around the corner, for example, when they were the most vulnerable, the forts could basically open fire. But the Brits knew about the taco forts.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Were they created for other invasions that had happened?
The Chinese had always made fortifications.
Okay.
But these were, they weren't quite up to the standards of European fortifications,
okay.
But they were more significant than anything the Chinese had built. So, the Allies first in 1859 would attempt to penetrate, but the Taku forts held. They would actually sink 4 British ships as they tried making their way inland, and the rest of the flotilla would retreat. But the following year, the Brits and the French came back with a massive fleet. 173 ships. 18,000 men. And, learning from what had happened the year before, they didn't just sail up the river. They landed their Marines. And their Marines went and basically attacked the fortified positions from the rear. Forts designed to hold off ships don't do well against guys. Once they seized the forts, they began sailing inward and would take out all the other forts along the way. When Beijing heard, they sent Prince Gong out again. But then something happened, and it's known historically as the Parks Incident. As the British army begins, well, the British military begins sailing upstream, Jiang Gufen sent Prince Gong down, and Prince Gong was to meet a British representative by the name of Harry Parks. Harry Parks, not Harry. Well, during the meeting, something happened that the Chinese took as an insult. So they arrest Parks and his entire entourage, and they quickly race back to Beijing. Then, some of the ambassador's staff would be found guilty of crimes. Some of them would suffer what the Chinese referred to as slow slicing. Although in popular culture, it's known as death by a thousand cuts. The Chinese mastered this torture tactic. What they would do is they would strap you down, and a torturer would come up to you with a very, very, very sharp knife. And they would proceed to take a little chunk out of you. And then as soon as they took the chunk out, the medics would come in and they would stop the bleeding and pretty much, not cauterize, but, you know, they would do their can to just repair the wound. And then they would ask you, whatever it is they're charging you with, are you guilty? And when you probably said no, they'd come back and they'd take another chunk and another chunk and another chunk. Well, you know what happens to your body when you start getting good chunks of your outer skin cut off? Eventually, you start taking chunks of muscle. And if that didn't work, they begin cutting off fingers, arms, limbs, usually at the joints. Well, eventually, your body suffers so much damage, you go into neurological shock, and often you die of a heart attack. But you didn't die of blood loss. No, they didn't let you bleed out. Well, word of this spreads to Europe, and the Europeans all across the continent are outraged. Because under European standards, you don't kill ambassadors. So, the Brits and the French respond with a message. They go back down to the Yangtze River, sail up, get within gun range of Nanking, and they open fire.
and they destroyed the entire summer palace, which is where the emperors would go during the summertime. Leveled it. And then they sent word, Beijing is next. The emperor gets this, he flees the capital. Prince Gong again goes out, meets with the Europeans. They hold a convention. Well, I use the old name. It's called Beijing today, but back then it was called Peking. In the capital. And they sit down and they adopt the Tientsin Treaties. China signs on the line. It accepts the terms. The only exception is the British treaty. In addition to the terms that I laid out, in the British Tientsin Treaty, they would be granted the right, a monopoly, to ship coolies to America. Does anyone know what a coolie is?
Cigarette.
No. That's cools. Although maybe you call them coolies if you talk in plural. But no. Does anyone know what a coolie is? A coolie is someone from China who sees their family get abducted by a gang, and then they're told their family will be killed unless you go in work and send all of your money back to the gang. So where do they go? Thousands and thousands and thousands would be put on British ships and sailed to California, where they would be used as laborers, not only in the gold rush, but also in the construction of the transcontinental railroads. They worked for pennies and did anything that was required of them because they were working for their families. Now, by the way, women were also taken as coolies. And guess what they did? We'll call them prostitutes, because that's what they were referred to over here. Now, one last point, because then I got to finish, then we're going to call it a day. Why was Britain shipping coolies to the United States in 64, 65, 66, 67? No. What was no longer legal in these United States?
Slavery.
Now, was this a violation of the 13th Amendment? No, because the coolies would come over and would contract themselves, make a business contract. And all the wages they got were sent home. That's legal to do, is it not? But the fact that they were here because their family was under threat of death, that was really not known in America. The other thing that the British demanded, the right to legally, and they got the right to legally bring in opium. And they were given a monopoly to sell opium in China. Last click and then we're done. This is definitely an understatement. This began the process of death by a thousand cuts to the Qing dynasty. The Europeans had no desire to conquer China. They didn't need to. They simply got these unequal treaties. They could flood the market with whatever products they want, and the Chinese basically had to buy them, and they couldn't stop it. But, like drug addicts, the moment the Europeans got a taste, Once those treaties expired, what do you think the next treaties were like? What do you think the treaties after that were like? It got so bad that by 1890, 90 ports in China were open up to European trade. There were hundreds of thousands of Europeans traveling all throughout China doing business, selling drugs. And they began taking more and more spheres of influence. Most of the major ports were controlled either by the British or the French or the Russians. The Germans would come in, the Austrians, even the Japanese. And most insulting, the embassies in the Forbidden City. When we deal with the Boxer Rebellion, I'm going to show you exactly on the map how close they were to the Forbidden City. But we'll just say this. They were allowed to be closer to the emperor than even Chinese nobles were. So, there's no need to conquer and topple the regime. We're just going to take it over from the inside. All for money. Questions? All right, so for those of you who came late, I did mention something to the people who were here on time. One thing to remember is that in this class, there is an attendance policy in which if you have perfect attendance, you get a bonus at the end of the semester. You're allowed only 4 absences throughout the term, and any absence over 4 will result in a penalty that's applied to your final average. So if you've missed lots of classes, your average is going to be impacted. The other thing that I want to throw out, I don't think I mentioned it to the people who are on time, papers are going to be due soon. Don't forget, April 22nd is when they're due, and the papers count as 20% of your grade. So if you haven't started working on them, you might want to start, because we're going to have another exam in probably 2 weeks, and then we're going to go on the final. Our final is on the Tuesday of exams, if memory serves me correctly, so that's the 6th. It will be in person. You are going to get a paper exam, and there's no open notes or anything like that. So you got to start taking good notes. You're going to have to start studying. Because if you don't figure out how to actually study, you're going to fail the exam. And the final exam costs equal to 35% of your average. So you might have cheated on the first one, and I didn't do anything. I caught some of you on the second one. Just kind of warning you, it's going to get harder. And if you're going to try cheating your way through it, you're going to end up failing the class. So, springtime is here. It's time for a rebirth. Refocus. Bring your A game for the rest of the semester and you'll be fine. See you on, what day is tonight? Thursday. I'll see you on Tuesday.